Om Gyanam Timuran Dasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So I'm offering my obeisances unto my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, who has so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was standing in the midst of darkest ignorance. So today I'm speaking the things that I have learned from Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master. He spoke to us through his books, through his speech, through his example, what he had learned from his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who spoke what he had learned from his spiritual master, spoke what he had learned from his spiritual master, and so on, one after the other, chain. Who is the first, the original spiritual master? That is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By definition, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the perfect person. You and I, everybody in the material world, we're imperfect. And from imperfect people comes imperfect knowledge. Our attempts at knowledge in the material world by gathering data with our senses is always defective. First of all, our senses themselves are limited. We can't see through this wall. Our senses only extend so far. Our eyes only pick up a little bit of the electromagnetic spectrum. If it's dark, we can't see. If it's too light, we can't see. So all our senses are prone to error. We see a little bit in time and space. And yet, on the basis of what little we know, that we've seen very little, mostly just the inside of our mother's wombs and very little else, still, we're making big theories about how the universe began, where everything came from, what is the nature of reality. And you'll notice about all these theories is they change all the time at about the same rate as people's fashion and clothing changes, because that's all it really amounts to. People get tired of thinking one way, so they change thinking another way, then they get tired of that, then they go on to something else. They make up so many different theories, because you know just a little bit. And what little bit you know, you want to tell a story about what life is like, or what reality is like. And then you learn a little bit more. Oh, we have to change the story around. I was once at sitting around with a bunch of professors. Some were in the physics department, some were in the religion department, and one guy from the religion department began to make some cosmic statements about life and the universe and so on. And a guy from the physics department jumped up and vehemently objected. He says, "How can you say these things? How can you make these big, sweeping cosmic statements?" He said, "We don't even understand a chromium atom. We don't even know how water flows through a pipe." So say you have your life to live. You want to know what to do with it. You need to know what's it for. Here I've got, you know, maybe another 50, 60 years in my hands. What do I do with it? Well, just wait. We're figuring out chromium atoms for the next 10 years, and then we'll go on to the next atom, and then when all the data's in, we'll finally let you know what to do. So you can hang in there and wait. So it seems like we're in a position where we need to have some answers. And if anybody who's a scientist who's truthful will tell you, we don't know anything, basically. We have very little we know. And whatever we do say we know keeps changing. I saw like a headline in one of these science magazines, Omni or Discover, one of those things. And it was about some new discovery, and it said, "We used to think da-da-da-da-da-da, and but now we know." But if I saw this, I was startled because I remember that when they used to think, they said they knew. And why are they saying now we know? Because now what you know in the future is going to be what you used to think. Maybe they say we used to know, but now we think. A little more honest. So that's the problem. You need some answers. You need to know what to do. You need some truth. And who's going to tell you? Who knows the truth? And then you can do like this. You can say, well, this is a problem. No one knows the truth. You can become cynical. But how do you know no one knows the truth? That's another big theory. That's also a speculation. Nobody knows the truth. You don't know that. Somebody might. How is it possible for someone to know the truth? Well, our senses are defective, and we make mistakes. We're always making mistakes. We spend a good portion of our life making mistakes, another good portion hiding them from others. That's mostly what politics seems to be about, is making mistakes and hiding them. And then apologizing for having made the mistake and apologizing for having hit it when they find out. Everybody is making mistakes all the time. Their senses are limited and imperfect. One becomes illusioned. You accept one thing for another. You may have all the data, but you just read it wrong. You see it wrong. And on top of that, you cheat. Not you, we, all of us in the material world, we cheat. What is the cheating? Just what I've described. I know very little, but still, I don't mind putting forward theories. I don't mind posing as an expert. I don't mind telling everybody how to live. That's called cheating. I don't know, but still, I claim to know. But this is our predicament. We want some answers. Well, there's a lot of people ready to cheat us. How do we know we're not being cheated? Well, this is our predicament. And when the universe was created by Krishna, seeing that this was our difficulty, he also created the handbook to go along with it. It's like when you get a computer, the machine comes from the manufacturer, very intricate, and it's really of no use to you unless you also get the documentation, the big thick book that tells you how to use it and what's it for and how to take care of it and what to do with it. Without that documentation, the computer's pretty much useless to you. You can sit around and bang on some buttons, won't do what you want to do. But the documentation have to be there. So anytime there's any production, there's some handbook, some user's manual. So when Krishna created the universe, he also produced the user's manual. That goes by the name of Veda. V-E-D-A. A Sanskrit word, which means simply knowledge. He can give us knowledge. The perfect person. From the perfect person comes perfect knowledge. This is the only way you're ever going to get it. From the perfect person. Anybody else, it's not trustworthy. So he comes and he delivers perfect knowledge in the form of the Vedas and hands it down. Just like this Bhagavad Gita here is handed down. Krishna spoke it to Arjuna. He came on the planet again 5,000 years ago. Also at the beginning of creation, it was revealed, passed down, handed down. And then he comes periodically to restore it. Because sometimes the distortions happen. So to make sure everybody knows what's going on, he reveals it again. So he hands it, it's given, and then it's handed down. One after another. From one student to teacher, student to teacher, student to teacher. This is the system by which it is done. Now you may think that, well, how reliable is that? After all, I'm talking about a chain of teachers and students going back thousands of years. How do we know it hasn't been distorted over the course of time? How is the integrity of this tradition maintained? Well, you see, it's not a simple thing. We play this game sometimes when people sit in a circle and I whisper a message in his ear and he whispers the message in the next guy's ear and it goes around the room and by the time it comes back, it's all distorted. So people think if there's a chain where this knowledge is handed down, that distortion will happen. But it does not, because people are properly trained not to distort. To get rid of the distortions in the field of knowledge. That is why, one reason why, the people who are in this succession are very careful about what they do and how they act. Because in their behavior, they eliminate those kinds of things that causes distortions. Knowledge depends upon goodness, upon purity. When things are heard properly, they'll be retained and kept properly if the receptive person is pure. If there's contamination, the contamination of lust and greed and anger, those things act like magnetic fields that bend things this way and that. And then knowledge becomes distorted. But if it comes from the perfect person, and the hearer in his way also becomes qualified to hear, then it can be passed down. Just all I have to do, all one has to do is preserve it intact. I don't have to be omniscient. God is omniscient. But if I can repeat to you what the omniscient Supreme Lord has said, then it's just as good. And in this way, this knowledge has come down in disciplic succession. This is the only conceivable way anyone can actually receive knowledge about the universe, stuff you need to know. Everyone needs to know this, because without it, we do not know how to live our lives. Because we don't have it, everything is messed up. Human civilization is a travesty. It's a parody. It's handicapped in so many ways. In former times, things were better. There was what we call Vedic culture. There is, in fact, a standard human culture. That also was created when Krishna created the world. Standard human culture. This is not something you'll hear about. Everybody thinks, well, human culture, anything we want to be. They think it's a concoction. Everybody more or less makes it up as they go along. There's no standard. You can be whatever you want to be, make up whatever rules you want to make up. It's only by our own convention that we follow. The idea that there's actually a standard human culture is not recognized anymore. It's been forgotten. But you'll notice, for example, there's a certain way that, say, bumblebees live. There's a standard bee culture that's passed down generation after generation after generation. They have their way of being. In Sanskrit, that's called dharma, their right way of being. There's a dharma for the bees. There's a dharma for beavers. They live in lodges. They chop down trees. They build dams. It's all hardwired in. There's also a human dharma that's established by the same agency that set it up for the bees and for the beavers and for the sparrows and whatever else there is. The bacteria that live in your guts, they all have their way of livelihood in getting along in the world. Also human beings. But the trouble is, it's not automatic for us. It's not hardwired in. It has to be known consciously. And that consciousness has been forgotten. So, my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, described this Krishna consciousness movement as a cultural movement for the re-spiritualization of the entire human society. And you will find in Srila Prabhupada's books a whole blueprint for how human life is to be led. It's to create a revolution. Not just a social revolution, not just a political revolution, but first of all and primarily a revolution in consciousness. If there's no revolution in consciousness, all of the revolutions fail. For example, first lesson in Vedic culture is we are not our bodies. That all living beings are spirit souls. And Vedic culture teaches us to see in that way. Not just to have a theory, but to see all living beings as equal. Bhagavad Gita says, Pandita Samadarshanaha. See every living entity as the same or as the equal. The bodies are different. And there's black, there's white. Imagine in Los Angeles if everyone was Pandita Samadarshanaha. They saw everyone the same. Crips and Bloods, blacks and whites, all this stuff, Koreans. What is this nonsense? Everyone is the same. Same spirit soul. And not only human beings and animals. What's this carting thousands and thousands of living beings every day to the slaughterhouse? Not seeing that these are like your brothers and sisters. Sure, they're not as smart. Suppose I have a younger brother he's kind of stupid. Does that mean I can kill and eat him? Yeah, they're animals. But they're still our kin. Because we all have the same parent, Krishna. So right there, just that consciousness, Pandita Samadarshana, that one who is wise sees the same. That itself will revolutionize human life. Not just the theory, but the actual practice of becoming free from this bodily concept of life, having the illusion of identification of the self with the material body removed, this maya that covers us. So there have been revolutions in the name of equality, and look what happened. In Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union, 70 years or so of communism, and as soon as it's over, everybody's busy killing each other because some are Serbs, some are Croats, some are Muslims, some are Armenians, some are Jews, some everybody, as soon as the old feuds came right back, as though nothing had happened. There was only some state keeping everybody from everybody's, cutting everybody's throat, and as soon as they got weak, they got right down to it. No revolution in consciousness whatsoever. Back in 1955, I was in the fifth grade. I also participated in a revolution. I was told it was a revolution anyway. I was going to school in Washington, D.C. In 1954, the United States Supreme Court had handed down a decision called Brown versus Board of Topeka that integrated the schools in the United States. And So I was to go for the first time. Washington, D.C. was one of the first places to actually integrate the schools. And so actually I was living temporarily in Washington, and I was in a street that was borderline between two school districts. So for 6 weeks I went to a school that was formerly an all-white school and now had a few black kids in it. And all the teachers were all uptight about that. Then the school board decided they made a mistake and I should go the other side. And I went to a school where I was one of a few white kids and everybody else was black. So I got to see it from both ends. This was supposed to be a big revolution, right? 1955. And how much has changed? Look what happened in Los Angeles. What happened to the revolution? Still, everyone is on the bodily platform. Big, big thing. One thinks he's black. One thinks he's white. Look at all the trouble we have. One thinks I'm male. Another thinks female. All the problems, all the fights, all the disorders that come about because of this business. So there's been no change. No change in consciousness. So this Krishna consciousness movement is, that's what it says, Krishna consciousness. It is built to get to the root of the problems. Actually, we are trying in the material world to solve our problems in a piecemeal fashion. And all these problems are really not the disease, they're symptoms. And if you have a deep underlying disease, you may treat one symptom successfully, but the disease will go on and it will come back, or the disorder will manifest somewhere else. So all of our material problems in this world, all our racial problems and economic problems and political problems and social problems and ecological problems, they're really symptoms of one big spiritual problem. And that spiritual problem is simply that we do not wish to recognize and behave on the basis that we are subordinate to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We have each of us artificially become the center of his or her universe. We are thinking, I am the Supreme. I can subordinate everyone to myself. It's like this. Say I'm a center, and you're a center, and you're a center. So you have these little circles, these spheres of interest. We have so many centers, and everywhere these circles overlap, their lines intersect, there's a conflict. We're not centered. But if we all understand that our real self-interest is Krishna, and we're all aligned there, then all the circles are concentric and there's harmony. So we have embarked on an artificial project. We have forgotten about our spiritual nature. We have forgotten about the Supreme Spirit. And we are now embarked on a project of trying to become the enjoyer and the controller in the material world. This is creating all our difficulties. We are adverse to devotional service to Krishna. And you see, we are teaching pure devotional service, and it is not so popular for people. Only a few are interested. Because the aversion is there. Even when we decide that, yes, I want to serve Krishna, I want to surrender to Krishna, still something inside keeps us back. This is our long-standing spiritual disease. So we have to work on the real problem. When that problem is solved, when the spiritual problem is solved, you'll see that then and there, all the other problems of human life will automatically, one after another, be taken care of. That's the only solution. So we're trying to introduce the standard human society coming down in this way. You may think, well, here's somebody else claims to have all the answers. And I guess there are lots of people claiming to have all the answers. That doesn't mean that somebody doesn't have them. It may well be that somebody has all the answers. How do you find out whether somebody has the answers or not? Our Krishna consciousness movement, we are providing a science. This Krishna consciousness is a science of self-realization. It's not just theory or religion or belief. It's science. By science, we mean that it's practicable. It's doable. We say certain things. There's knowledge, which is information that's contained in the Vedas. But what we are interested in is realized knowledge, experiencing those truths for ourselves by our own direct experience, our own direct perception. Right now, we're in a state where we cannot see. This illusory consciousness by which we identify ourselves falsely with the material body is keeping us in ignorance. We have to dispel that ignorance. We have to change our consciousness. And this bhakti yoga is about changing our consciousness from material consciousness to spiritual consciousness. You may say, well, what is the spiritual consciousness? How can I understand what it is? Well, you can get a taste of it by the simple process of chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama.